Hello, and welcome to the TA teleconference, Making the Most of the Author-Editor Relationship, Insights from an Author and Editor, presented by Elsa Peterson and Bruno Dick. Elsa is a freelance editor with 25 years' experience in the college textbook industry. She has been doing editorial work primarily for the college textbook industry since 1984. Although her academic background is in music, she holds a BA with highest honors from the University of California at Riverside and an MA from Case Western Reserve University. Her versatile editing talents have led her into a wide variety of disciplines ranging from the arts and humanities to psychology, business and management, human physiology and nutrition, and foreign language. She was a senior development editor for psychology with McGraw-Hill Higher Education and has freelanced for virtually every leading textbook publisher in the U.S. In addition to manuscript development, she is experienced in permissions editing, picture research, and writing content for textbook ancillaries. Based in Norwalk, Connecticut, Elsa offers a discount to TA members who use her editing services. Bruno is a professor at the I.H. Asper School of Business at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, Canada. He received his Ph.D. in business from the University of Alberta in 1991 and has published dozens of articles and papers, many in leading management journals and publications. He serves as an editorial board member for several scholarly journals. His first textbook, Understanding Management, Current Practices and New Directions, has just been published by Cengage. I now turn the teleconference over to Elsa and Bruno.
Well, thank you, Kim. I'm always flattered to hear such a description of my background. I was hoping that we could start out with just a quick poll of those of you who are participating in the conference. If you are muted, if you could unmute yourself by pressing star 4. We just wanted to do a little poll of how many of you are veteran textbook authors, already have a book that has been published?
All right, and it's 4-star. Sorry.
Oh, 4-star. Okay, thank you. Anybody?
I am Myrna Rochester. I've been both an author and an editor.
Great. Okay, and then is there anyone on who is a first-time textbook author who's just in the process of preparing a book for publication? So you have a publisher, but your book hasn't come out yet?
Yes, Ross Aiden from Rockford, Illinois, and I'm doing a textbook on religious studies in the middle of the development of the book right now with a publisher.
Great.
Hi, I'm Sally Hunter, and I am working on a proposal, but haven't contacted the editor yet. It is a book on social studies through the fine arts from a course that I teach. So I've written a couple of chapters, but haven't presented my proposal yet.
Okay, and that's actually our next category, a soon-to-be textbook author with a manuscript and or a proposal somewhere in the process of finding a publisher or signing a contract.
That's me.
Uh-huh. Anybody else?
This is Malcolm Kahn. I was in the prior category. I'm Miami, Florida, and I'm in the midst with my wife as co-author of writing a textbook for first-year experience college classes, and the book is right now, the second draft is being sent out to reviewers. So we're in the middle of it with a major publisher.
Okay. And then anybody?
A university book, and for a management principles course. I tried hard to make it the same as all other textbooks in that area, sort of to make it easy to adopt. We talk about mainstream management. On the other hand, we talk about multi-stream management. So each chapter has sort of two flavors of management, and the multi-stream management says, what would management look like if, instead of saying it's there to maximize profitability, what if it's there to maximize multiple forms of well-being? So you have financial well-being as one of them, but so is social, spiritual, ecological, aesthetic well-being. And what if it was for multiple stakeholders? So owners are important, but so are employees and suppliers and customers and neighbors and future generations, for example. So that's the book in a nutshell.
Great, thanks. And how I know you, Bruno, is that I was lucky enough to get hired as a maternity leave replacement for your in-house developmental editor. And so I came in at the stage when your book had been turned over to production And most of what I did with you was to get the ancillaries started and sort of shepherd your book through the first few months of the production process when you were starting into copy editing, when we were starting to look at the book design, and all those kinds of things that happen at the production stage. So in terms of my interactions with you, I completely missed out on the earlier stages of editing, but I did get to see your book when it was close to being finished, which was exciting, because I could really see the final product taking shape. So backing up to the beginning, long before I ever met you, Bruno, when you set out to become a textbook author, what did you bring to the table, and what were your expectations for the process?
Well, I had already probably had two drafts of the book done before we had gotten okay from a publisher to do it. So this is a book I've been working on for at least 10 years already, and getting my scholarly foundation in place so that this isn't fluff, that this had legs in that way. And I had gone through it for 2 years in the classroom. So the first version was probably, 150 pages, and then it grew up to 300 pages or so, but there's still a lot to be done to make it a full-fledged textbook. So that's what we brought into it. We sent it out to a number of different publishers, or I wrote a proposal. At first, I just aimed for one publisher. I was a bit naive at that time, and that publisher didn't want it. So then I said, okay, I'll send it to two or three publishers. And in the end, we had two, publishers bidding for it. So we were, we had to choose between a bigger publisher and a littler publisher, and there's pros and cons for each of those. So that's what we brought to the table there.
And when you say we, you have a co-author, Mitchell Neubert at Baylor University. And how did he come on board?
He came on board actually relatively late, probably, in the process. When I had the book, when the proposal was accepted with just me as the author, but there was an understanding that we would have a co-author. And, he knows micro-organization behavior, and I'm a macro-organization theory person. So a management textbook has both sort of the psychology of organizing and the sociology of organizing. So we complemented each other that way. And the fact that we were going with a U.S. publisher, and I'm a Canadian, it was, I think, valuable to have a U.S. co-author on the team, too.
And did somebody introduce you to him, or did you already know him? And did your publisher ask you for a list of possible co-author names, or how did you
We knew each other from conferences that we had attended. Actually, at one point, I thought my co-author was going to be a friend of Mitch's, and we were going along, and then Mitch sounded interested, and I thought we might have three authors at that point, but then the original friend dropped out of the process, and Mitch and I carried the ball home, so it turned out well that way.
Uh-huh. And since you had already been working with this manuscript and testing it in your classes and everything, did you feel like it was just sort of a matter of taking it through the goalposts in the editorial process?
Yeah, I was quite naive coming into it, I have to say. I mean, I didn't realize how much the publisher would do and how much needed to be done yet in this whole process. So I thought, well, I've got a pretty good working copy here, and I've read other textbooks, so I know how to write this. This isn't going to be that much more work, but it's a lot of work. Even once you have a good working draft in place, there's still a lot of stuff that needs to be done, and a lot of people need to help you to do that stuff.
Okay, well, and let's go into some more of the details of that. There was a lot of reviewing, from what I understand. You had some pre-signing reviews.
That's right. The process for us worked out. We had, I guess, two or three chapters. Well, first we sent a proposal, and then people said, yeah, this is good enough. Give us some draft chapters that we'll send out for review. So we had three chapters that we sent out to review, and those were pretty full-fledged chapters. They had lots of bells and whistles already built into them. And they were sent probably each to 10 or so reviewers who said, you know, well, are you interested in this book or not? So once we had the green light there, then we actually went out to one publisher. They flew us out there, and we got to see some of the senior editors there and talk to people. That was a useful thing for us to do. So we chose the publisher, and then they basically set up a schedule for us and said, we want three chapters sent out by this date, and then another 3 months later, another three chapters, or whatever the times were. So they laid out a schedule, and we agreed to it. And each chapter was probably sent to, you know, 10 different people to take a look at, too. So it had a lot of touches, and those people all give feedback. What are strengths and weaknesses? Do you have ideas to improve the chapter? And also, you know, would you adopt this book or not? Sort of that kind of a test. So we had a lot of feedback, a lot of input. We knew what the people were liking. You know, they liked this writing style, but you know, they thought this was a bit too forced, and have you thought of this as an example and stuff. So we had a lot of good feedback in that process.
So they suggested specific examples for you as well. And you used the word touches. That's a marketing term.
Mm-hmm.
I've also heard it called seeding adoptions.
Right.
It's a technique by which the publisher gets your material out in front of as many people as possible, gets them to sort of know your name and know the basic theme of your book, so that when it eventually does come out, they'll be a little bit familiar with it. They'll say, oh, yes, I saw some of that in review, and then they'll be more interested in seeing the finished product.
That's right.
Okay.
One thing that we never know who those people are, those reviewers.
That's kept confidential, right.
Right. But in the feedback, one thing that I would have liked more of is input from people who are scholars and experts in that area, and maybe it was sent to those people, but their feedback was more at a how can I use this as an instructor rather than does this have the scholarly integrity and have you thought of this source or that source or you can fatten this up. And I guess it's because as an academic, that's what I'm used to from writing to journals, people bolstering the scholarliness of the work that I do. And here was more bolstering the teachingness of the work that I do. And I've sort of missed the scholarliness too, because it's always nice to know you have the latest and greatest stuff being cited there.
And you also went out to seek some critiquing on your own, apart from what the publishers
That's right.
were doing in the reviewing process, right?
That's right. I wrote two drafts of the book to start with, and then before I submitted the final draft that would be sent out to the publisher, I had a friend who is an experienced textbook author, and we sort of bartered a deal where he would read it and give me feedback and say, you know, the transition from here to there isn't working very well, or maybe try putting this section over here in this chapter instead of in that section where you have it now. Or, you know, you need some examples here, Bruno. This is getting too heavy with just the theory. You know,
too theoretical, huh?
Yeah. So that was a very useful thing, too. So the chapters we sent out were they weren't polished, but they were in pretty good shape, I think. And that was how it came back in the review process also.
Yeah.
What happens is when we got the review process, there of the 18 chapters, there might have been two or three chapters that were not that we're pegged as we need to redo this. You know, this one is a bit confusing. This is getting some mixed signals. So let's improve this chapter, send out a second draft to reviewers and see if we've addressed those issues. So there were a couple of weaker chapters in that group, but for the most part, we sailed through that part pretty quickly, I think.
And I'm interested a little bit more about this barter arrangement. What did you offer him in return for his critiquing of your material?
We did a lot of scholarly stuff together, too. So we've been doing research together as a team for a while. So he knew that by me going into the textbook writing mode, I wouldn't have as much time for doing scholarly stuff. So I said, well, if you help me out with this, then I'll keep that part of my job alive, and we'll keep publishing along those lines. So that was sort of the gist of it there.
I see. Maybe would this be a good time to open it up to questions, see if the listeners have any questions they'd like us to answer about what we've been talking about?
That sounds good, yeah.
Kim, maybe you can remind us what to press to unmute ourselves.
This is Malcolm Kahn. I found them. Can you hear me?
I can hear Malcolm, yes.
I can hear Malcolm.
Okay. My question was, how thick of a skin did you feel that you needed to deal with the reviewer comments?
Not very, actually. And maybe it's because having published in a scholarly journal, you get a pretty thick skin from that, so this isn't that bad. The comments were, for the most part, constructive. The I mean, in my case, the book wrote itself a little bit in terms of which topics should you put in. Should you put motivation in this chapter or in that chapter? Should you do, you know, leadership? Which models of leadership should you do? Because I was sort of following the industry norm there. So when people said, oh, I like it better if you put this topic in that chapter, I knew that 5 out of 6 top-selling books put it in the chapter I put it in, so I figured I'll stick to what I... So in that sense, I felt fairly confident in some of those decisions that we made that other people maybe had their opinions on, so I didn't feel, I don't know, threatened by that or whatever. And if they did have helpful comments, that's beautiful. That if it improves your book, I'm a happy man for it to prove my book. So I didn't feel like I needed a thick skin in terms, you know, they weren't taking... I guess some people are criticizing the book and they weren't interested in it and stuff. So, but that was always a minority, so that's fine. People have different tastes, different kinds of books that they like, so that didn't threaten us either, I don't think.
I think I'll say from being a developmental editor and seeing lots of reviews over the years, there are often outliers, you know, reviewers who either have a certain viewpoint that if their viewpoint doesn't go along the same lines as what they're reviewing, they'll have a lot of negative comments. Or you'll have a reviewer who just sort of doesn't get it, doesn't, for example, with the multi-stream, mainstream dichotomy that is the main theme of Bruno's book, there might have been, and I didn't see the reviews in this particular case, but there might have been people who just sort of didn't get it, didn't feel like that would be helpful in their course.
Yeah.
And so you take those with a grain of salt. You figure, okay, we can't be all things to all people. But if we have 10 reviewers and 8 of them are saying, yes, I like this, I would just like to see a little more emphasis here, or I'd like to see this switched around. But they basically think that the book is a worthwhile contribution, then you kind of go with that.
Yeah, I mean, for us, we were also quite conscious of the fact that this book was not all things to all people. We weren't trying to hit the gray middle. We were trying to hit a certain part of that market. So typically, I would say, well, maybe 20% of the reviewers were actually opposed to what we were doing. No, management is all about profit maximization. What are you saying that we should care about the environment? So 20% were not interested. And another third or so were really very interested. Wow, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. Finally, we're saying these kinds of things in our textbook. This is wonderful. And there's a group in the middle say, yeah, this is sort of interesting. You know, I'd like to read some more. But they weren't excited one way or the other. So the fact that there is people cheering for us always seemed to offset the people who weren't interested.
All right. Any other questions?
Hello?
Hi. Yes, this is Ross Aiden. I've had various reviews from the proposal on the various chapters or parts of chapters and so forth. And frankly, the book I'm working on is pushing the envelope a bit. And so I have some reviewers, I think, that get it and get the method and would accept it, and others that don't. Now I'm waiting for another set of reviews again. So it seems like I've been reviewed a lot, and I'm wondering whether you might have any comments. Do you think that I'm beginning to suspect that the editors, since I'm a new author too, are a little hesitant, you know, and are trying to find some way to get a green light on this project. What do you think?
Well, for me, it was important. One of the reasons we chose the publisher we did is the publisher we chose got it. So they knew we were doing something different, and they wanted something different. So they weren't trying to hit for the gray middle and make everybody happy or whatever. So it sounds like that's sort of your strategy in your book. You know it's going to appeal to some people who want a fresh air on whatever the topic is you're writing about. So if you say, that's my target market, and if your publisher says, yeah, that's right, this is the size of that market, and let's run with it, then everybody should be happy. And the more feedback, the better. I always thought the more feedback, the better. I was always happy for feedback.
I think you told me you had something like 100 reviews in all from beginning to end.
Yeah, it was probably more like 150, actually, yeah.
Wow, yeah. So Ross is your name, I'm sorry?
Yes, right.
Yes.
That's really to the point, because I thought maybe, you know, I don't have anywhere near 100 reviews,
okay.
You know, for what I've done so far. So.
Yeah, I mean, I've been in a number of meetings with developmental editors and directors of development telling us, if you have reviews that say, yeah, this is pretty good, yes, I might consider adopting it, but you don't have any reviews that say, I totally love this book, I can't wait till it comes out, then it's not good enough yet with a first edition. That, you know, that you will really be driven to get the manuscript to the point where it's really offering something special that isn't already out there in the market, so that you'll have at least a few reviewers saying, yes, this is the book I've been waiting for. I really want to see this book come out.
That's a good point.
There was a lady who also started to speak.
Yes, this is Veronica Watson.
Hi.
And I guess I was
Hello.
Trying to understand a bit more about the various reviews, because it sounds like these are not reviews that might, for instance, cause the project to be rejected at any stage. So we're already clearly committed in terms of a publisher is clearly committed. This is just about strengthening the project, or are these reviews at some point, is it possible for the publisher to say, we're not going to go with this because we're not getting the reviews that we thought we would?
For us, we signed the contract, so there's sort of a good faith, let's go ahead with this. I personally saw the reviews more as constructive and how can we improve it, but theoretically they could have pulled the rug on us, and I know of other situations where they said, okay, these reviews are strong or there's some misgivings here, we don't want to go ahead with this now. So just because you have a signed contract doesn't mean that it's going to go ahead.
Yeah,
but
I have
me,
seen that happen too. When you particularly like if you're getting reviews saying no, I would not adopt this book, even if my criticisms could be addressed, I still don't think that this author is offering anything that's particularly valuable that I can't already get in another book. If you're getting quite a number of reviewers saying that, the publisher may opt to basically buy you out of the contract.
Okay, thank you.
This is Sally Hunter. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I would like to ask a basic question because I have not submitted my proposal yet, and I'm always worried that I am not going to be accepted simply because I didn't follow the exact guidelines of the proposal that was presented by this particular publisher. And then did you follow those guidelines exactly before you presented your work, or did you submit your own material and your chapters with that very first proposal? How did you go about that for acceptance or rejection?
Hi, Jim.
For me, the proposal process, it was fairly flexible. I mean, people wanted different things, so we changed the proposal accordingly. But the important thing for me in writing the proposal, and the publishers also said, this was a very well thought out, rigorous, almost scholarly kind of a proposal. You know, you could read the proposal and you knew something was happening here. This wasn't something that somebody had written up over a weekend kind of an idea.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was a real strength of ours. I haven't seen enough proposals to know how it relates to others, so I'm sure Elsa has more to say than I do.
Well,
and you did submit a chapter at the same time as the proposal?
I think the first, I don't remember now. If they like the proposal, then they'll ask for chapters before they do anything else. I'm not sure if I wrote the chapters and proposal at the same time. I think first it was just the proposal, and then they ask for the chapters, and then the ball starts rolling.
Thank you.
I would say if that piece of the publisher's guideline I would follow. If they say don't submit a chapter until we've seen your proposal, then go by that.
All right.
As far as, you know, if they say, well, your proposal has to have five parts and your proposal has six parts to it, I mean, that's probably not going to knock it out of the running. But if there's, you know, somebody on their end who receives proposals and they clearly know in the guidelines it says don't send us any part of your chapter until we've seen your proposal, and you don't follow that instruction, then they say, okay, this is an author who doesn't follow instructions. And
yes,
so that's, you know, it's like if one of your students does an assignment contrary to your instructions, you might still say, well, I was a really smart student, but, you know, he or she needs to learn to follow instructions better.
All right. I really appreciate that.
So,
thank you.
Yeah. So I guess maybe we're ready to move on. I was going to ask you, Bruno, a little bit about the pedagogical features, because your book has a lot of them. You have a roadmap at the beginning of each chapter, and then you have an opening case and a closing case for each chapter. You have a feature called Inspiring Cases. You have practitioner examples. You have management in practice. You have what do you think boxes. And then at the end of the chapter, you have hands-on exercises, end-of-chapter questions, and you have your key terms that are defined out in the margin, and then they end up in the combination glossary index at the end of the book as well. So I was wondering how you came up with these features and if they were all in your manuscript to begin with or if they got suggested by reviewers or somebody on the editorial team as you were going along.
Mm-hmm. Yes, all of the above. The roadmap was sort of my idea. Most textbooks start off with, here are the important items you're going to do. Here's a list of questions you'll be able to answer at the end or whatever. And that
right,
never really,
learning objectives, sure. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And that never really worked for me, and I don't think students particularly like that, but that's maybe just my bias. So a roadmap was sort of a visual table. I'm a visual learner to start with, so it was a visual table that said, here's where this chapter is going to go, and here are the two parallel columns, the mainstream and multi-stream approach to the key topic areas. And that reviewed very well. People liked the freshness of that. That was sort of a fun thing. The cases, most textbooks have cases, so they said, yeah, we should have cases, and that was good. It was important for us to write interesting cases. Many textbooks have sort of blah cases, and we purposely chose organizations that we thought were interesting, that had an interesting story and a subtext to them. And my students have told me, in other textbooks, they never read cases. In my textbook, they read the cases because they're interesting. So that was a big affirmation on that score. In terms of other pedagogical feature, these special feature boxes that came through our discussion with the editors, what should we call them, how many should we have in each chapter. So in our first draft, we already had some of those special boxes, but we sort of made that more generic and said some of them will be what do you think boxes and some of them will be management and practice boxes. So we sort of crafted it along those lines. There's a lot of end-of-chapter stuff that I wouldn't have had in my drafts, but we decided it was a good idea to put them in there. So we have what we call hands-on exercises at the back. We have end-of-chapter discussion, questions for reflection, and those are all developed here. There's some the Glindex, actually, there I was happy that I had a bit of a hand in that. Most textbooks have a glossary and an index, and I thought it would be more helpful for students to have the glossary and the index put together in a Glindex, and I'd seen that in other textbooks, so that I think that worked out well.
You know, it's a good way to save space in a book, and the sales reps always say that the shorter books, the thinner books, do better than the fat books.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just showing it to someone else the other day that I was working with, and they had not seen a Glindex before.
I think it's also better for the student.
Yeah, I opened it up in your book, and he said, wow, that's great for, you know, students who want to make sure that they understand what they're talking about,
because
the definition is right there.
And then
generic, the person who acquires the book, the person who signs you.
So it was a group decision with my co-author, myself, the developing editor, and the sponsoring editor, and I mean, we all had our ideas, and there was feedback from the review process. What do the reviewers want? There's knowledge of the industry, and that's where the sponsoring editor and the development editor, too, but for us, in our case, the sponsoring editor knew the field very well and knew which books had been in the past and which ones weren't working and what people wanted. So that kind of feedback or that kind of knowledge, my co-author and I would not have been able to have it in our back pocket. So that was very helpful. How many photos should a chapter have, and how many special features? You don't want too much, and you don't want too little. So finding that right balance and how long they should be and sort of the design of the chapter, I was very happy to have professionals leading us in that regard.
Great. And so by the time your manuscript got turned over to production, which was, I guess, shortly before I came on board, at that point you had worked with how many different editors? And then you got this whole new cast of people from the publishing company putting your manuscript through production, right?
That's right.
So you had, at that point, you had had your signing or acquisitions or sponsoring editor, and you had had your developmental editor. And anybody else?
Those were the two that we were working with the most. There's people in the background. I guess we hadn't really gotten into the permission stuff yet.
That happens after it goes to production.
And sometimes we had talked to the sponsoring editor's boss, whoever that person is. But it was basically a sponsoring editor and the production editor. Those were the two that we spent, and the developmental editor. Those are the two we spent the most time with.
Right. So then once you went into production, you had a production editor or project editor, and then the manuscript went for copy editing. You started looking at the design.
And at that point, it's almost like a magic trick. You know, we've done our work, and we hand it off, and all of a sudden there's a whole bunch of people that you don't really know, and all of a sudden you're getting emails on this and that, and all these things start happening to the book that you wouldn't have known really needed to be happening. And once they're happening, oh, yeah, I guess somebody does need to get permission for all of these. And the copy editing, oh, yeah, we have to – I mean, the copy editing was nice because I think it helped us to homogenize a bit the writing between my co-author and myself, because I think we both write quite well to start with, and we had, whatever, a couple of drafts already under our belt and reviewer process and all that stuff, but there's still sentence structure and crispness, and to have a professional do that was a useful thing. For me, the funnest part was choosing the pictures, and at first I just assumed somebody else would choose the pictures and have some blah kind of pictures that all textbooks have. But then, well, here's six pictures to choose from. Choose one of these and write up some reports on what kind of pictures you want. And that was a real opportunity for me. And I enjoyed it, and it became sort of like adding chocolate chips to the textbook, where if you can have a picture tell 1,000 words, you know, I think they're called photo essays or something. You have a picture, but then you have maybe a three-sentence caption that goes with that picture. So here's a child labor person from somewhere in Africa, and here's what their life is like or whatever. And then, that puts this whole text in a little bit of a different context, a much bigger kind of a picture, so to speak. So that was a fun part, and to have the professional say, you know, here, find a picture like this, and they come back with six, and you pick the one you like the best. You say, these aren't good enough, go look some more. And they were in very good spirits, so they were happy to help and make the book look great. So that was fun.
Yeah, good. There was, I think, in the handout that we sent out, there's a link to a blog post about what it feels like to be copy edited, and I thought I'd just read these little quick deciding factors that this guy is naming for what goes on in copy editing when the copy editing changes come back. Number one, is the change good? Number two, if I don't like the change, was there a problem in the original that I should fix? And number three, is the copy editor right grammatically but wrong stylistically? And I think that can really be important, because as a developmental editor, a lot of times I've worked very hard with the authors as the book gets written to have a certain style, to have a certain authorial voice that's accessible, or that we want to have a certain level of rigor. And then when it gets into copy editing, sometimes the copy editor won't really tune in to that authorial voice, and they'll just be sort of fixing things that aren't mm-hmm. actually wrong, but that they're thinking, well, this is better grammatically, and they're actually messing up the style. That can really come into play. And then the fourth point that he has on here is the copy editor an idiot and didn't get the joke, or is this just not funny? So if the author's trying to be witty and maybe it didn't come across well, that bears looking at. And last, does this section need to be rewritten or maybe entirely scrapped, or have new paragraphs added to explain something further? And that's something that, as a developmental editor, I try to catch that earlier on. I will flag something and say, if this is worth mentioning, then it needs more explanation, mm-hmm. because the author is just going along sort of, you know, mentioning something in part of a sentence that I, as a lay person, will say, I think I know what you're referring to, but I don't know that a freshman student would even have any clue what this is about. So, you know, is it worth spending the space to put in a few more sentences to explain it, or should we just leave it out? That's the one thing in his little list on this blog post that I think ought to be dealt with before you get to the copy editing stage.
And that was dealt with mostly by my friend who I had bartered with, and he would say, you can't use this word unless you define it. These are first-year students. This isn't part of their everyday knowledge, so
right. Oh,
yeah, have to slow down and do this. So that was a helpful thing there.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, the change. My biggest fear going through the copy editing process was that my voice would be lost.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some very positive feedback in the reviewing process. Hey, the voice of this textbook is a little bit different. It doesn't feel like a textbook. It feels more like you're talking to me or you're writing to me. It had a bit of a breezier kind of a voice. And we probably did lose a little bit of that. But I think in terms of, you know, homogenizing the two authors, I think that part stayed. I was happy with the end result on that. And for me, even in other work that I've done, if I read something and I say, hey, they changed it, it's not any worse, it might be a bit better, it might not be better, it probably is better. So I have a pretty open-minded, or if somebody's going to take the effort to change it and I don't think it's much worse, then it's probably better. So I would say, well, at least 95%, even more, of the copy editing was non-problematic. It was improving it, making it crisper, and that was fine. There were a couple of times where, because I have expertise in the area, that, hey, no, you can't go here. This is slipping a little bit too far or whatever, so you had to pull in the reins or you had to change it back to where it was, kind of an idea. And then you usually try to improve where it was, too, because you had been signaled that it wasn't that good. But the copy
editing process, that's one of the points that he makes here, is that if I don't like the change, was there something that I should fix in the original?
Right, yeah. So that was a bit of a fear maybe going into copy. Oh, no, are we going to have to do this all over again? But it went relatively smoothly and quickly in our case. So maybe we had a high-quality copy editor and maybe other people have other stories. I don't know.
Well, maybe we should highlight the difference between copy editing and proofreading, too. So copy editing happens when your book is in manuscript, when it's getting ready to go into page proofs, and then proofreading happens in page proofs. And so the proofreader's job is supposed to be just to make sure that the corrections from copy editing were properly implemented,
mm-hmm.
and to catch anything that didn't get caught before, that is an actual typo, as well as things like a loose line or a poorly laid out page, things like that. But the proofreader isn't supposed to go in and mess with sentences that were already correct in the first place.
Right.
And unfortunately, I worked on one book where the proofreader took it upon him or herself to make a whole bunch of changes. And luckily, I guess, the authors screamed really loud and said, this cannot be allowed to go through. And so a lot of what the proofreader had started out doing had to get undone. And in fact, they even missed the bound book date, which is like the cardinal sin in textbook publishing. You never want to lose your bound book date, but we actually did have to postpone it by like 10 days or something. And then the authors and I and the production editor worked over a weekend to undo a lot of this. And I think that particular proofreader got sort of blacklisted after that, because the responsibilities for proofreading don't extend to going in and changing perfectly correct sentences. So I just wanted to air that in case anybody's in doubt about what's the difference between copy editing and proofreading. Let's see, permissions as well. I think one thing that I got involved with at a really late date was that permission was denied for something in one of your cases,
that's right.
I remember.
Yeah.
It was talking about a particular company, and the permissions editor was having trouble getting a response out of them. And when they finally got a response, the company said, well, you've misrepresented how we portray ourselves, and we really would rather not be in your book.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to come up with something at the last minute to substitute for it. We couldn't just remake the book to omit that
right case.
And we just did some Googling around and found websites for a couple of companies that we thought might fit, and then luckily one of them worked out, right?
That's right. Yeah, there are a couple of those little glitches where there was a photo we weren't allowed to use, and we had sort of referred to that in the company in an end-of-chapter case. So, and then you have to sort of find the new example that fits into the same number of lines and as the old one, too, because there's not much room for spillage of pages. But it all worked out fine in the end.
Mm-hmm.
Some
yeah.
frantic moments there, maybe.
So, let's see. We can maybe move on. We have one more topic for you, and then we can open up to questions again. Marketing. How's marketing going now that your book is out on the market?
It's not going as well as I would have hoped. And well, I shouldn't say that maybe in those words, but what happened was our company where we had signed was sold out and were purchased by a larger company.
Cengage.
So our book got lost in a larger book bag, and it got in a company where the senior editors and the developmental editors and the marketing people hadn't all been involved in forming and shaping the book, so they didn't have as much ownership of the book, I think, as the first company did. So I think it got a little bit lost in that larger book bag, and we're looking at that now. We're trying to improve that. So I'm optimistic that it'll do better, but right now it felt a bit like it got lost to us.
Well, and on that hopeful note,
yeah.
Maybe we can open it up to questions again and see if any of our listeners have questions for you at this point.
Yes, this is Veronica again.
Hi.
And I wonder if you could speak a little more about the marketing aspect of it. At least some of the conversations that I'm having with authors really indicates that a lot of the responsibility for that has sort of shifted, or if not responsibility, then authors are at least feeling the weight of needing to market their own books much more than they had in the past, perhaps. And so, I mean, was that something you negotiated during the contract phase? Is it something that you had a conversation with at the beginning that helped you choose a publisher? I wonder if you could just speak a little more about how that unfolded during the process.
Well, to be honest, when our company was, when the smaller company that we had signed with was bought by a larger company, we thought, oh, now we are benefiting from this larger marketing arm. There's more salespeople in the sales force and stuff like that. So on paper, that could have been a big advantage too. It's not something that was negotiated up front. I mean, there's a lot of permissions and all that. Who's going to do all the ancillaries? Who's going to write the test bank? And who's going to do that? Those things were sort of negotiated up front in the contract. But the marketing itself, that is the company's responsibility, I would say. That said, we also I would provide names to the people, saying to the publisher, saying send review copies to these people. I met them at a conference. They sounded very interested. Or here's a list of people or a list of schools that are doing things that are sort of consistent with what our book is talking about. Maybe target those things. The more you can do in terms of planting seeds or tapping people on the shoulder, the better it is. So we're probably doing. They never really asked us to do that. We sort of volunteered to do that, and we're continuing to do that and maybe doing it even more now than we did. Well, I don't know if we did more. We're still working at that. I guess we know the industry better in some ways than the salespeople do, so we can target things some way. But theoretically, that's their job.
Actually, one thing occurs to me as you're talking. Do you have a particular person in the marketing department that you and Mitch can contact? Can you, do you have an email address where you can send and say, by the way, I'm going to be giving a talk next week, and can we get some comp copies to display? Or, do you have a person that you can talk to?
Yes, is the short answer. We said here's a conference. We should really add a book display here, and then they said, yeah, we'll get a book display there, even though they weren't planning to do that. So they've been supportive in that way. There's no
mm-hmm.
doubt about that.
That's good.
Again, this is Ross calling. I have a question. With all the reviews that you've had, are some of those reviewers then used for marketing? Do they turn around and say, well, you've written a good review on this, now would you help us with the publicity?
That's my understanding, that part of that whole review process, those touching and those seedings, are to seed potential adoptions too. And saying, well, now the book's come out, you guys give it a fair review, are you going to adopt it? And I know on our outside of our sleeve jacket of our textbook, we have some of the quotes from the reviewers. You know, this is the best thing since sliced bread, kind of an idea.
Yeah.
In retrospect, I wonder if those people could have been used more deliberately or whatever. Now the book is out, you know, here they are. Do you have any ideas of people we should send it to or whatever? I think there's probably an underutilized resource that was there, but maybe there's, I don't know why it's not industry standard to do that. There might be good reasons for it, but that thought occurred to me too, what you're mentioning here.
Thank you.
I have a question. This is Malcolm Kahn. You mentioned the maps at the beginning of the chapters. Was that considered line art, and did you have some kind of limitation on line art?
I think I'm not sure what line art means.
Well, I can answer that question, and I'm looking at one of your maps.
The larger story behind that roadmap is it's on two pages, and we have a very big picture sort of that spans both pages, which the designer, the textbook, and that's a thing we didn't talk about. They have people who tell you or who help you design a textbook and say what colors you're going to be using and what should this look like at, and it's great. It's a wonderful thing. But on that one, they had said, well, it's going to cost too much to have these big pictures spilling over two pages. We want to save some money and do something different. And both Mitch and I said, no, that different doesn't look good enough, and we want to stick with what you had said we were going to do. So then they did say, okay, we'll stick with what we said. But now you can tell your story, Elsa.
Oh, okay. Well, the way your roadmap is laid out, it's not line art because it's basically a typographic table. It just sort of walks the student through the main points of the chapter, somewhat the way a chapter outline would do. So it doesn't, in terms of the production process, it doesn't qualify as line art. I'm sure that your book was set up with a budget for a certain amount of money that could be paid for photos and a certain amount of money that could be devoted to line art. And so whether they shared that directly with you and Mitch or not, they had in mind a certain number of pieces of line art that you could have for each chapter and a certain number of photos. What line art is material that couldn't be reproduced on a typewriter. Usually how I tell authors to judge whether something needs to be called a table or a figure. If it's called a figure, it's a diagram, could be a pie chart, it could be an actual rendered drawing of something, like the human digestive system. You know, you couldn't reproduce that on a typewriter, except for the thing where you use a whole bunch of X's and, you know.
Right.
But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about regular old-fashioned typing. You have, for example, you have a figure of the 360-degree feedback appraisal method. So there's a little drawing of a lady sitting at a desk, and then it has customer with an arrow, boss with an arrow, peer with an arrow, and subordinate with an arrow. So that's something that needed to be created by the art studio rather than something that was typographical.
Okay.
And that's why it's considered line art. And then there was an old term, halftones, that used to refer to photographs because photographs have shading in them. They have gray and, you know, black and white areas and shading. Nowadays, the photos are almost all color. But line art tends to be black and white, and it can have colors in it too, but it doesn't have the infinite gradations of shading that photographs have. So from a production standpoint, it's handled differently. Cartoons are line art.
I have one other quick question. Do you have an instructor's edition, and why or why not?
Definitely. We have lots of ancillaries. We have an instructor's edition. We have test banks that have, I think, like 150 questions per chapter. They even made audio summaries, so our students can now download onto their iPod a five-minute summary of each chapter. So the bells and whistles are all there, and we didn't, we helped a little bit shaping and guiding that stuff, but those things happen mostly behind the scenes. An instructor's manual is probably that, and the DVD are the two things that a potential adopter said were the most important ancillaries, and the test bank for sure, were the most important ancillaries.
Thank you.
So we just have a few minutes left. I think, Bruno, you had a couple questions for me.
Mm-hmm. You must have, you've been doing this for 25 years. What kind of tips do you have, or what kinds of do's or don'ts do you have that authors should be aware of in terms of keeping the publishing houses happy with us and the editors happy?
Okay, well, I'm try to do this in a nutshell here. Number one, recognize that the editor, whatever editor you're working with, they want the same thing that you as an author want, which is for your book to be the best it can be. So it may seem like the author is being a real pain in the you-know-what, but they may be acting as a devil's advocate because they don't want you to look silly when the book actually comes out. So they're sometimes willfully misreading what you've written, saying this could be misinterpreted by a careless student to say the opposite of what you're actually trying to say. Or they could look at a design idea that you have and they say, you know, this just really isn't going to fly with very many people. It may fulfill your vision as an author, and you may have, you know, great artistic taste, but I can tell you that, you know, prospective adopters are going to look at this and say, what? So listen to them, because they want your book to be the best it can be, just like you do. The next point is to be realistic and honest about the schedule, or schedule, as Bruno said. When a publisher commits to do something with an author, it depends on when is this going to come out, and they've got this all calculated into their expenditures and their anticipated revenues. And if you can't hold that schedule, they need to know that. So at any point along the way, if something comes up in your life, or you just realize that you've gotten overcommitted or whatever, be honest with them. Don't try to avoid. I mean, I know it's the easiest thing to just sort of disappear, don't answer emails for a while, and just think, well, somehow I'll get caught up and then I'll talk to them again when I can see my way clear to get my chapters done. Then you're leaving everybody else hanging, so nobody knows what's going on. The best thing you can do is be honest and say, you know what, this semester has just turned into a complete train wreck and it's going to be the first of the year before I can do anything. Just tell them. Next is be aware that the definitions of key terms in almost every textbook I've ever worked on, the definitions of the key terms drive so much of the rest of the book. So it's important to choose your key terms well, you know, make sure that those are the terms that students are going to need definitions for, and then realize that they're not only in the glossary of the book or the Glindex, if you have a combined index and glossary, they're also going to drive matching exercises, flashcards, quizzes, audio quizzes, even the test bank. So if you then later on decide that something doesn't need to be a key term, or that you're changing one of your definitions, that can affect, you know, 20 other things down the line. You also want to have some sort of balance in the number of key terms from one chapter to another. You don't want to have 50 key terms in one chapter and only 3 in another, because realize the students are going to feel like they have to learn all of them. So why do we have to learn 50 key terms in this chapter and only 3 in another? Probably the last thing is learning objectives. And Bruno was just saying he's not a big fan of those things where it says, once you have studied this chapter, you will be able to do these 5 things, or you'll be able to define or explain these 5 things. I've heard a lot of authors say that they're not a big fan of those kinds of objectives. But in fact, they're in there, even if they're not articulated to the student, even if they're not set forth at the beginning of the chapter. They should still be in your mind as an author. Why am I writing this chapter? What do I have to say here that somebody's going to learn? And if you can't articulate that, then you're kind of wasting everybody's time. So that is going to drive the test bank, all of the stuff that goes along with your book, because people are using your book as a learning tool. That's the whole idea. So those are my little tips.
Very good. Another question I have for you is, why would somebody want to hire a freelance editor like you? It sounds like you do all these neat things and read all these cool books and stuff, you know, a lot of stuff.
Because I'm a really fun person to work with. sometimes as an author, sometimes you just want somebody to look at something before it goes out before the larger public. So I can look at a proposal and you know, just critique it, say, does this make a lot of sense? How could you make it stronger? I sometimes get hired by, I have a relationship with a few academics who anytime that they're going to submit like a chapter to an edited book or they're going to submit an article to a journal, they have me look it over. And it doesn't take a whole lot of my time, doesn't cost them a whole lot of money. It just gives them a second pair of eyes to look something over. The big jobs that I do are through the publishing companies because I may earn $10,000 over the course of a couple of years in being the development editor for a book from beginning to end. And obviously an author wouldn't make that investment. They would be stupid to make that investment if you didn't have a publisher. But so those are that's my main job that I do is working for publishers. But I love to be able to work directly with academics. And I work on trade books as well as textbooks. You know, sometimes academics will write books for general readers that are going to be sold as a, you know, $24.99 paperback in all the local Barnes & Noble stores. And I love to work on things like that as well.
This has been an educational presentation brought to you by the Text and Academic Authors Association.